Gee, that went fast. This is Linda Smith behind us right now. Longtime friend of WFMU. I believe she's been sending her cassettes to us since the 1980s. If I'm not mistaken, she may have appeared live on Andy Walter's program back in the day. This is an untitled track number 10 from a newest release of hers called Titled and Untitled Music 2021 to 2023. Moon Brothers preceding that, which is moniker of one Fred Schneider, different guy, pal of Josephine Foster's, as a matter of fact. His great LP is called The Wheel. We heard from it Maps of Hearts. We heard Emily Robb, who put on a great set in our Monty Hall this past Friday night. She's got a soundtrack now for a film called The Space Between Attack and Decay on Petty Bunko. We heard from that Shiny Sister theme. We heard from that great Sundays compilation of two 1940s theremin albums, including Music for Peace of Mind, music by Les Baxter, Harry Revel, and Dr. Samuel Hoffman. The song My Troubles Float Away Like Falling Leaves. Dean Elliott with his orchestra before that from Zounds. What Zounds from 1962, the track Rain. Citrus out of Padua, Italy, did Sushi. God, we heard a lot of songs this set. NT Fan before that with The Secret Mausoleum of Mankind, Fetish Miniatures of the Suicided Races. The Frogs did Bear from Hopscotch Lollipop Sunday Surprise. Magic Pacer did Deathbed from White Room. And Benny Jesseret, way back at the top of that set, from The Great Insane Box, did Kuru Cuckoo Cuckoo Cuckoo. My name's Scott, and I look forward to seeing you again next week, friends. Have a great week and a great weekend. And stay tuned, because Mark Hurst is coming right up. Tectonic is next. Bye. This is WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City, in Rockland County at 91.9 FM. Worldwide online at WFMU.org. Bye.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, I'll be your host for the next hour. Great to be with you. We are going to be talking about attention today. That's our theme. We're going to be speaking with Peter Schmidt and talking about a new book that he edited called Attensity, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in a moment. I just want to say, on last week's show, I had Paul Bradley Carr on, and if you didn't hear that one, it was a good conversation. He talked about opening an independent bookstore, his very own bookstore. He and his wife opened a bookstore in Palm Springs, California, and he talked about seeing younger customers come into the store who were clearly interested in a print book. And he hastens to add, you know, if you read an ebook or listen to an audiobook, that's fine too. But he's just observing that a lot of the younger customers would come in clearly looking for something on paper because, he said, they seem to be so fatigued of looking at screens, just screens everywhere. And I'm guessing that you know what I'm talking about, friends. The profusion, the proliferation of screens in our world has really affected our attention. And if you just think about our attention span, what are all these screens doing to our attention span? There are some studies that show that the average person's attention span is going down year over year. But, you know, when you think about it, it's not just about that, because, you know, what if attention is something more profound, more important than attention span? And that is an idea that we're going to be getting into with Peter Schmidt. And I may have some things to say about that idea as well after the interview. But for now, let's go ahead and listen to my interview with Peter Schmidt. By the way, if you want links to the book, Attensity, and Peter Schmidt's various projects, you can go to the playlist, which is at tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Just click the link for the Peter Schmidt Attensity episode. Let's go ahead now and listen to that interview with Peter Schmidt here on Tectonic. Peter Schmidt, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you for having me.
You've got a thoughtful and provocative book just out. It's called Attensity, A Manifesto of the Attention Liberation Movement. And we should clarify, you were involved in writing this book, but you're not listed officially as an author. The book, according to the cover, is by The Friends of Attention. Who are The Friends of Attention, and how did they and you write this book?
Yeah, that's right. It's a pretty special book for a few reasons, but one of them is that we genuinely wrote it collectively. There were some 30 people involved. Those people are all Friends of Attention, and the Friends are an informal coalition. We call it a coalition of the willing, of folks around the world who, over the past 8 or so years, have been getting together around a shared concern for the politics of attention. So there's a lot of artists, there's a lot of educators, activist types, parents, all sorts, who have come to see attention's role in an industry that is newly exploitative on a scale that basically nobody could imagine 20 years ago. So people are concerned with the emergence of the so-called attention economy. We have our own metaphor for how exactly that industry works. And so we've been organizing over the past 8 years to think about this new moment, which is bewildering in interesting and generative ways, and also to, you know, figure out what we can do about it beyond individual self-help cures. So the Friends are all sorts. We're all over the world. And over the past 3 years or so, we've been working on this book, which kind of crystallizes a lot of the thinking that we've been doing together. And we're very, very excited to see it go out into the world.
And we should say your two co-leaders within the Friends, if that's the right title, are D. Graham
Co-editors.
Yeah. Co-editors. Okay, thank you. D. Graham Burnett and Alyssa Lowe. Do you divide tasks? Do Graham and Alyssa have special skills that they bring to the conversation?
They certainly do have special skills. For background, Graham is a professor of history at Princeton. In fact, for his day job, he does a lot of deep scholarly work on the history of the scientific study of attention. And Alyssa's a filmmaker, so she has very close connections to the art world. I myself wear my organizer hat most of the time. And the book is a kind of nice synthesis of scholarship and art world thinking. We have a lot of, we're very influenced by the work that's come out of the arts, and a call to action, you know, so that's the kind of organizer energy that's in the book. In terms of process, you know, writing a book alone is hard enough. Writing it among 30 people is a special task. And it's, you know, it's kind of hard to say who is responsible for different parts of the soup. But the three of us kind of led the charge, partly because we had published a piece on the politics of attention in the New York Times in November of 2023. So it felt right for us to kind of coordinate folks. But there were some 30 people involved in the making of this book over the course of 3 years. And more, depending on how you kind of do the numbers. And everybody brought something special to it.
So you've got this book that's been in development for 3 years, as you say, led by three editors and around 30 writers from around the world, different backgrounds and professions and so on, talking about attention. And that's unusual enough, but there's another unusual aspect to this book, which I appreciated. The format is not your standard, you know, chapters and sections. Instead, this book, Attensity, starts with a two-page, what you call, Manifesto of the Attention Liberation Movement. And then the rest of the book goes sentence by sentence through the manifesto. For each sentence, there's a short essay on that topic. Tell me a little more about that design choice.
Yes. The central idea of the book. So if your listeners come away with knowing one thing about this project, it is this. New technologies make possible new forms of exploitation. And over the past 20 years, we've seen the emergence of new technologies that can powerfully capture, command, and commodify, turn into money, human attention. They can monetize, you know, the most intimate part of ourselves, our capacity for curiosity, our capacity to be interested, our capacity to care about the people in our lives. That constitutes a totally new form of exploitation. And it's cornered by the five or six biggest corporations in the world by market value. So there is a lot of firepower behind our little glass screens. Our big idea is that to respond to this, we need nothing less than a movement. We need movement politics to protect our attention and to see us through this scary moment. And when you're talking about a movement, you're getting people up off the couch, right? And so 300 pages of analysis are not going to get people off the couch and into the streets. There are books that give 300 pages of analysis, and we recommend many of them, and they're all great, and we think of them as like players on the same team. But this is a call to action. It's a call to organize around the protection of our attention. And so, you know, the genre that corresponds to a, hey, get off the couch, go do something, get together with your people, is a manifesto, right? There's like a long history of radical political thought that uses the manifesto form to rouse folks. We were also writing a book, so that raised the interesting creative challenge of how to reconcile the punchiness of a manifesto with the depth and rigor of a book. And so we came up with this funny structure that, you know, puts the manifesto front and center. You could put it on a poster. In fact, over the past month, a number of attention activists in our coalition have been wheat pasting copies of the manifesto all around the city. And then, as you said, we decided that each chapter of the book would be a kind of explosion of a line in the manifesto text. So over the course of the book, you see the manifesto over and over and over. You see a particular line that's pulled out in orange font. And then you turn the page and there's an entire chapter elaborating on that single line. It's also kind of fun because it functions as a kind of like paper hypertext it's sort of like clicking a hyperlink on a website and seeing that one line explode out into another page. We don't know anybody else who's made a book like this, and we think it's pretty fun. And we also think it kind of, it does both jobs. It maintains the urgency of a manifesto, but it also gives us the opportunity to sort of show that, hey, there's real thinking behind this. We really have done our homework.
Yeah, I think the idea of using the hyperlink metaphor in a book is good, but it's not quite accurate in this case, because if it was really true to the hyperlink experience, you would have to be collecting my data without my knowledge or consent and selling it off.
That's a great point. It's a very good point, yeah.
I wanted to talk about this central concept of attention, because I'd say roughly the first half of the book is just establishing what you mean by attention. And I appreciate that you're quoting various thinkers and writers on how they define it. For example, you quote Jenny Odell, who's a past guest on this show, writing in her book, How to Do Nothing, that attention forms the ground not just for love, but for ethics. It seems like you see attention as something bigger than the common definition of attention span. We'll get to how that definition came about. But for your concept of attention, how are you trying to get readers to understand attention?
Yes. The book makes a few big moves, and one of them is conceptual. It's a move that seeks to change how people think about attention. And what we found is that so much of the conversation about attention these days, and there's a lot of conversation because people are getting hip to the fact that attention, this very slippery thing called attention, is deeply tied to a lot of the problems we're seeing in the world, whether they be kind of mental health related or political or interpersonal. People understand that something's afoot with our attention. The ways that people are talking about attention reveal the trace of a kind of hidden history that we're doing some work to uncover here. And to kind of cut to the chase, we've seen that the discourse around attention, the way people talk about attention, is almost always thinking about attention in terms of a kind of quantitative focus that is serving time on task. So it's like an attention that lets you to be with a task, get stuff done, and most often do that in relation to a screen. You can call it a cybernetic attention. That's kind of a $1 million phrase. That way of thinking about attention is very strange, very, very strange. If you had, you know, a time machine and you went back and spoke with medieval monks in the scriptorium who were fretting about their ability to, you know, be with God and to complete their illuminated manuscripts, and you said, hey, you know, my attention span is messed up, that would actually have been an extremely foreign phrase to those people. There are many, many, many cultural traditions that see attention in much broader terms. And here's why we came to have this phrase, because as we recently wrote in a piece in the New York Times opinion section, this notion of attention span, of attention as something that can be kind of quantitatively assessed and optimized, comes out of a bunch of laboratories over the course of the 20th century. Those laboratories belonged to psychologists who were tasked with slicing and dicing attention, figuring out exactly how this nebulous thing called attention could be measured in a laboratory. In circumstances like this, you always have to follow the money. And as it happens, the military was doing most of the funding of that research because the military was newly concerned with optimizing young soldiers' ability to sit in front of screens and shoot down airplanes. So this was the rise of a field called vigilance studies. Now there's, you know, perhaps nothing wrong with all of that, but the very narrow form of attention that can be measured in a laboratory, that came to be measured as a kind of tracking and triggering of a person's eyes and the quantitative measurement of like how long they could look at a screen without dozing off and missing a little radar blip, came to dominate the popular understanding of attention over the past 100 years. So when people talk about their attention span, they are actually borrowing from this research tradition. Attention span started as a measurement that was spatial. It was like, how much information in a single flash can you take in at once? Now it's come to mean a kind of durational measurement of time. How long can you stick with a task? But the point is, if we're trying to rescue our attention span, if we're trying to rescue this form of attention that is quantitative, task-oriented, and happening in front of screens, we might get that back, but the only thing we're going to win is the opportunity to send a few more emails. So we're calling for a movement here, and to have a movement, you need to organize around something that is sufficiently compelling that lots of people from lots of different backgrounds can get together and agree that it's important. If you take a step back from the kind of cybernetic machine attention that seems to dominate the conversation, if you give yourself some time, if you get to go read a book, or indeed, if you spend time sitting at the bed of somebody you love who's sick, pretty soon you're going to realize that attention is a much, much, much deeper, wider, more delicate, more complex thing. It's our curiosity, it's our care. Simone Weil said it's akin to prayer. And lots of cultural traditions, artistic traditions, political movement work, they all have thought about attention in different terms. So the friends, the friends of attention, we take very seriously that task of, defamiliarizing attention, expanding our collective understanding beyond this very narrow band of machine attention. And this is partly why, the friends built the School of Radical Attention, which is here in Brooklyn. It's a little nonprofit. I run the school. We commit ourselves to this very question. What can we possibly be talking about when we're talking about attention? And we're committed to a kind of endless unfolding of that question. So everybody has an intuitive sense of what attention can be. It is nothing less than the stuff that our experience of the world is made up of. If we can all remember that attention is richer and more precious than attention span can possibly express, then we're going to start to understand that this is something that really is worth protecting and organizing around. And that's the beginning of the second move of the book, which is, hey, we need a movement.
I appreciated that you wrote about the history of quantifiable attention span, as you say, being funded by the military-industrial complex, seeing how long soldiers could look at screens and dials and things, and how narrow a conception that is compared to the full reality of attention, which you write, and I'm saying you, I mean you and your co-authors, repeatedly say, In its full reality, attention cannot be quantified. I mean, a little slice of it can be, but but the really important parts of attention, like the really important parts of life, are not suitable to be chopped up into discrete little bits and counted up and calculated. And yet, the money still today in quantifying attention, maybe not so much military-industrial today, more big tech money today, is continuing the process with more and more effective, in a way, procedures for doing that. You have this phrase that I liked a lot in the book, human fracking. Describe that. What is human fracking?
It's our proposal for an alternative way of talking about the problem. So most folks know the phrase the attention economy, which was coined in 2001, I believe, by a pair of business consultants who were writing a book describing the attention economy as, this kind of exciting new moment in the development of business and advertising. And the attention economy, it sounds kind of friendly. It sounds like the kind of thing that a young, bright-eyed college graduate might approach to make a name for themselves in the world. And, it fails to capture the violence of what these things do. So, human fracking, metaphor, drawing on the idea of hydraulic fracking. I think many of your listeners will know what this is, but it bears repeating. It's pumping a bunch of gross, soapy water deep down into the earth to break up the shale, the rocks in the earth's structure, and to release the tiny little bits of petroleum that would otherwise be inaccessible, and to suck up those bits of petroleum to the surface, where they can then be processed, turned into oil, and sold. Fracking produces a lot of oil these days, particularly in the U.S. It also does a lot of damage. It has been shown to contaminate groundwater. It pollutes the water. It causes, you know, instability in the Earth's crust. It's a perfect, what you might call, homology, which is a fancy word for saying the structure of what's going on is perfectly identical in hydraulic fracking with the Earth to what's going on with human fracking to our mines. So these big companies, they pump tons and tons of low-quality content out of the screens into our eyes and into our minds, where the pressure of these, you know, videos and notifications and texts and all the rest break up our attention into smaller and smaller bits that can then more easily be sucked to the surface, compelled to place our eyes on a particular corner of the screen, extracted, that is, selling that eyeball time to advertisers, and then turned into money. And the analogy holds insofar as, you know, fracking makes the Earth unstable and polluted. Human fracking makes our psyches unstable and leaves us the worse for wear. So that's what's going on with these companies, and that's what we're pushing back against.
Yeah, that's an effective metaphor, especially when you see psychological crack-ups like we're getting with AI psychosis, these sad cases where people maybe had some mental or emotional instability, and then the big tech platform comes in and just blows it all apart. And what you're saying is, to some extent, this is by design. These platforms are designed to break people apart in order to extract what the companies want.
That's the business model.
Okay, so we have a clear and present danger that we're facing from these multi-trillion dollar companies that are arrayed against us in our best interests. And by the way, this is nothing new for listeners to this show. I've been warning about this for years, so it's a pleasure to have it so clearly delineated and diagnosed in this book. But the book doesn't stop there. As you mentioned earlier, the book goes on in the second half to talk about what we can do about it. And you're pretty clear that you're not after individual solutions, you know, use your willpower to do this or that better. Instead, you're trying to build a movement. You write about attention activists and the importance of community and moving forward. What is the cultural and political change you're trying to bring about?
A useful analogy here is the emergence of the environmental movement in the kind of middle of the 20th century. And this analogy, I think, captures the shift in consciousness that we're looking for. But back then, in like 1959, the Hudson was on fire. It had been the dumping grounds for a bunch of upstream corporations that were just kind of shooting their volatile effluents into the water. And you strike a match and throw it onto the surface of the Hudson, it would go up, and it did. Back then, people could look at that and say, well, that seems pretty gross, but what the heck am I going to do about it? You know, like, I can't really make any individual choices that are going to push back against the scale of the destruction that's being wrought on our water and on our air and on our soil and as an extension, on us. And that last bit is the hinge here. That's the crucial hinge. Because people began to understand, thanks to, in part, the work of visionary advocates and investigative journalists like Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring, they began to understand that the environment was the kind of enabling condition for their well-being. If you want to be well, you got to breathe clean air. You got to drink clean water. You have to have clean food. Otherwise, your body is going to resemble the contaminated environment that it moves through. We're in a parallel moment here, right? We're seeing this massive despoliation of an environment, except for instead of it being the external environment, it's the internal environment. It's, you know, the world of our consciousness, it's the world of our minds and our senses. And back in the 60s, people got hip to that. And they started to talk, and they started each in their own way to say, hey, we need the environment to be in better shape. And we care about this, and we understand that this is like, this is affecting us directly. And so you got this fascinating coalition of white shoe lawyers, even some corporate executives, duck hunters, hippies, concerned Midwestern moms, who all of a sudden understood the environment's role in human well-being and in the well-being of their kids, and recognized in this new understanding the opportunity for a politics that organized around the environment. So you got this national coalition, super diverse, of people that managed to push through a series of landmark federal legislative victories and regulatory victories over the course of the 60s and the early 70s. What we're looking for is a similar response. We need people everywhere to look at their attention, to feel their attention, and understand that it's deeply tied to their well-being, to understand that it's something deep and wide and precious and something that deserves protection. And then we need people to organize around it, to have communities that are dedicated to protecting attention and to thinking more deeply about what exactly it is that they're trying to protect. If we can have a wide-scale cultural recognition of attention's central role in human flourishing, then we have the ingredients for the kinds of political change that can bring these corporations to heel. So there's both the cultural transformation, which is kind of the work of our group, you know, because we're artists and writers and thinkers and organizers. And then there's the kind of political victories. We need both in this moment, and to score political victories, you have to have cultural momentum behind it. And we're at that moment of cultural change. And we really think we're there, you know? That's the thing. They say, never let a good crisis go to waste. And there's a funny irony here that the very moment at which our attention is being, you know, broken up and taken from us and despoiled is the moment where we say, hey, I have attention. This thing is important to me and it's being messed with. And I'm seeing it for the first time and I'm understanding how important it is and how like central it is to my way of being in the world. And so that's a kind of flip of the crisis. You say, hey, we're losing our attention, to put it kind of crudely, but we're also discovering it again. And if we can all discover it together and understand how important it is, then we have the conditions for the scale of change that we really need to see right now.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We're a little over halfway through my interview with Peter Schmidt, who is one of the three editors of a new book called Attensity, A Manifesto of the Attention Liberation Movement. And I say the word attensity like that because there's an exclamation point at the end of it. If you'd like a link to the book and Peter's School of Radical Attention and some other resources, go to the episode page for today's show. It's at tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. Click the link for the Peter Schmidt episode. And let's go ahead now and listen to the remainder of my conversation with Peter Schmidt here on Tectonic. One way people might push back on that idea is to say, well, Peter, I love your idealism, but we're facing however many trillions of dollars of market value, the most powerful and influential companies on earth, maybe ever, are opposed to what you're talking about. It's inevitable that the technology is going to continue to despoil our attention and everything else. And I liked how you talked about responding to this claim of inevitability. You write that in his 1978 book, Injustice, the American historical sociologist Barrington Moore Jr. wrote about resisting things commonly said to be inevitable, saying, quote, "The conquest of this sense of inevitability is essential to the development of politically effective moral outrage." So how are you orienting your efforts to fight against an attitude of inevitability that it can be kind of common out there?
Yeah, you named such an important part here. In our conversations with folks, both, you know, around the book, but even more so through the school, which does a lot of work with the community, we do all sorts of free programs where folks come in and talk about this stuff, we see so much shame, right? People have been convinced that as parents, as professionals, as family members, their relationship to these exploitative devices is a reflection of some personal failing. And that's the first reframe to say, wait a second, there's $14 trillion on the other side of that screen. You don't stand a chance. This is not something to be ashamed of. What we need is for people to take that shame, that sense of despair, and flip it and convert it into political outrage, right? We should be furious that these companies have been siphoning the consciousness of our three-year-olds and turning it into money with zero regard for the developmental well-being of these kids, to give one example. So we need outrage. And outrage is powerful because it doesn't take for granted the conditions, right? Outrage says, this is bad, this cannot stand, and this is, the world doesn't have to be this way. So pushing back against inevitability is extremely important. And it's particularly important when the situation is so totalizing. Again, you know, these companies control so much of our lives, our social lives, our kind of commercial lives, our professional lives, our informational lives, how we learn about the world. So you've got to push back against that inevitability. And that's one of the most important, you know, jobs of what we do. And to go back to what you said earlier, you know, that very good point about these corporations are so powerful, $14 trillion, if you do the numbers one way, you got to remember this. They're making money out of us. We are what power these companies. It's like in the Industrial Revolution, you saw the emergence of these new technologies that were shiny and impressive, and in themselves, not inherently exploitative or evil. They were quite amazing, actually, the steam engine and the factory format. And they were able to concentrate, organize, and extract labor, the kind of like movement of people's bodies, from humans in a way that was never before possible. And as we know, that brought about new forms of exploitation and of pain and the destruction of traditional lifeways and all the rest. But the laborers got hip to the fact that these machines, as powerful as they were, needed human labor. Like, they were machines that centralized human labor. And they found out that if you can withhold your labor, the machines stop, right? And this was the kind of origin point of labor politics. It was not possible before these technologies were invented. If you, even 100 years before, had seen a bunch of feudal peasants going on quote-unquote strike, you would not have had a strike. You would have had a bunch of hungry peasants because what they were growing was their own food. So the central kind of realization that gave rise to this new form of labor politics was that these machines run on us. And if we can withhold ourselves, if we can direct our labor in other directions, if we can form collectives of solidarity, we actually can gain purchase on the levers of power. And that was a kind of realization, you know, 200 years ago, about people's ability to withhold the labor of their bodies. We're seeing a similar moment where new technologies are exploiting our minds and our senses and our, you know, our spirits, if you believe in that sort of language. And we have to recognize a similar thing. These machines run on us, and we are the ones with the power in the situation. Now, that's not to trivialize the task. It is an extraordinarily steep climb ahead of us. And there's no guarantee. there's no guarantee under any circumstances that you can push back against such a powerful suite of corporate forces. That said, it's not going to happen any other way.
I wanted to make sure that we said something about the title of the book, because you're driving at a proposal or an inauguration for a new movement, and you're calling it Attensity. That's the title of the book. And you write that Attensity is our motto for this bold campaign. I thought this was just a new term that you and your co-authors had coined. It's like intense attention or something like intensity plus attention, I guess. But you write that it's not a new term. You write, back at the start of the 20th century, Attensity was used by a group of early psychologists. Their leader, Edward Titchener, not only came up with the term attensity, he also coined the word empathy. Tell me a little bit about this term attensity. What does it mean to you, and what does it mean, and what should we take away from that?
That's right. So a bit of the history here, because I think it's helpful to place these things in context. Titchener was one of a number of psychologists who basically thought that you could understand psychology by looking at what was going on inside your own head, rather than putting subjects in laboratories and treating them as black boxes with inputs and outputs. And so they experimented with a bunch of methods of kind of observing what goes on inside one's own mind. And that advanced an idea of attention that was principally concerned with experience. You know, it was a little hard to quantify. And it was principally retrievable by paying attention to attention. That approach as a scientific method more or less went out of style. The black box psychologists won out. Turned out that they had more useful kind of ways of treating humans as kind of devices that could be understood. And that's not to speak ill of their work. They have done a lot of good in the world. And attensity, the phrase, kind of fell out of use. We are going back, scooping it up, and hoisting it aloft on our flag and saying, hey, attention to attention is the new consciousness, new political consciousness that we need in this moment. We need to pay attention to our own attention. We need to ask ourselves what it is, and we need to understand why it's worth protecting. And, you know, this move of going back, taking a sort of obscure scientific technical word and then like treating it as like the rallying cry for a political movement might seem kind of weird, but we have to remember that this has happened before. We'll go back to that moment in the 60s, which is proved such a useful analogy. If you had asked somebody in, you know, 1930 what they thought of ecology, they would have had no idea what you're talking about. Ecology was a very particular scientific term of art used by a bunch of German zoologists who studied like how energy moved up and down food chains out on the tundra. But right around the middle of the 20th century, as people began to observe the destructive impacts of new forms of industry on water, on air, on soil, they said, hey, those guys were kind of onto something. This idea of ecology, it captures really nicely this notion that we're all connected, you know, and like we need to think of an entire ecosystem when we're talking about the formerly narrow domain of human well-being. And so what they did is they went back and they scooped up ecology and they put it on their t-shirts and they said ecology now. And what they did is they took this obscure phrase and made it the kind of catch-all term for a political sensibility that could bring together a lot of people around the protection of the environment. Attensity is, we hope, a similar phrase. It refers to the fact that our attention is deeply tied to our experience of being humans in the world, and that it is deeply tied to our well-being. And we hope that it can give people the tools to recognize that we're all on the same team, right? We have, you know, anti-tech activists here in Bushwick. We have concerned moms out in Clayton, Missouri, where I'm from. We've got artists in the Pacific Northwest. We have people all over the country who are concerned about attention. And what we're hoping is that attensity can be a kind of common phrase to bring these people together and to understand that we really are all on the same team.
Okay, Peter. So there are listeners hearing this, I'm sure, who are saying, I totally agree with the diagnosis of the problem. I'm intrigued with this idea of attensity and a new movement. What would you like them to do? You mentioned the School of Radical Attention that's based in Brooklyn. I know you have partners and or followers around the country. What is your recommendation for people out there for what they should do next if they're interested?
Get together. Bring your people together and talk about your attention. And bring your people together and do the stuff that you already like to do. Stuff that still sits beyond the reach of these corporations. Stuff that may seem apolitical. It may be like a book club or a knitting group or a monthly dinner party that you run or a hike that people take in the woods together. Take these things and keep doing them. But recognize that somewhere out there is a business school graduate with a tie and a blazer and a PowerPoint deck that he's presenting to a bunch of VC investors that says, this thing that you love doing, where you're out in the world with people that you love, can be turned into an app and made into effectively an extractive business model that'll get him rich. Because that's how all these social media companies started. They took stuff that was more or less innocuous, like sharing knitting patterns or, you know, looking at cute freshmen at your college. We can debate how innocuous that was. But point is, it was pretty common. And they turned them into these extraordinarily powerful machines of exploitation. The thing that you have already in your life that makes you feel closer to the world, that's actually a point of resistance. If you can protect that and cultivate it with other people, if you can do the stuff that you already love, you are creating a space that's protected from these powerful corporations. And if you can do that consciously of attention's role in the bigger picture, if you say, hey, we're doing this thing we love, we're also practicing attention and protecting attention, then you formed what social scientists call a mobilization structure, which is a fancy way of saying when things get bad and people everywhere understand that they need to act, they have pre-existing communities and relationships with whom they can coordinate action, right? They can say, hey, everybody in the gardening group, we're going to get on this bandwagon and we're going to help drive political change at the highest level. So what we need are communities of solidarity where we're protecting each other's attention. And the beautiful thing is those communities don't have to take up transcendental meditation or read big, heavy books by Shoshana Zuboff about surveillance capitalism. They can do the stuff that they already love, because what they already love is an attentional practice. I would say that's the first thing. It's like, get together, understand that every time you get together, you're protecting your attention, and continue to share the good stuff with the people in your life.
Peter, how can we keep in touch with what you're working on?
We're the Friends of Attention. We are a scattered coalition around the globe who have been thinking about this stuff for a long time. We are literally friends. This isn't like a cutesy name. And if folks are interested in getting involved with the Friends of Attention, they can find our website. I think it's friendsofattention.org. Reach out. We'd love to hear from you. I run the School of Radical Attention, and this is where a lot of the activist work is happening. So we're here in Brooklyn. We're a nonprofit. We do lots of programming with the public, lots of free workshops and seminars and pop-up study groups throughout the city where we think about this stuff together. Folks are welcome to come out and join us in our space in Dumbo or throughout the city. And if there are listeners who are farther away who say, hell yeah, I'm an attention activist, I want to do this where I live with my people, then we're here to support you. And we have on our website an invitation to join a growing national coalition of attention activists. We have some 70 folks around the country who are doing organizing projects in their communities. So if you go to schoolofattention.org and click on the Get Involved drop-down tab, the first link says Join Our Coalition. You can put your name in, tell us what you're up to, and we'll get you tapped in with folks around the country who are doing this too.
Well, it's all very impressive. And Peter, I wish you and all of these communities the best. This is important work. And this is an important book. It's called Attensity, A Manifesto of the Attention Liberation Movement, written by the Friends of Attention and co-edited by you, Peter Schmidt. Peter, thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Mark.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining few minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Peter Schmidt, one of three editors of a new book called Attensity, A Manifesto of the Attention Liberation Movement. And as you heard me say, I was intrigued by this unusual design of the book, in which they start the book with the manifesto itself and then move on to expand on that manifesto line by line, sentence by sentence throughout the book. And it does a good job of explaining their position. I mean, they, as Peter said, they are looking to create a movement. And as a movement, they're trying to look beyond individual solutions. So it's not so much encouraging an individual here or there to take up mindfulness or to use a different web browser or something, but rather they're trying to create some momentum, some political and cultural change. And I think that's a viable model. I think it's really interesting. And it's worth pointing out that this movement is, as I read it, I mean, Peter didn't say this during the interview exactly, but I see this as explicitly anti-big tech. I think they have correctly identified the destructive and exploitative vector in the world today, and that is the eight dudes on the west coast of the U.S. that are trying to engage in what he calls human fracking. They're trying to exploit, destroy, monetize anything and everything they can. And just to back up this assertion I'm giving you, let me just read you a brief quote from the book. This is from near the beginning of Attensity. It says, "At the time of our writing, the five largest companies in the world are each valued at more than $2 trillion U.S. dollars. All five of these are technology companies: Apple, NVIDIA, Microsoft, Alphabet, which, you know, is Google, and Amazon. And four of the five have billions of customers who use their products more or less continuously and whose data commodification constitutes a central business operation." And so the book, Attensity, doesn't dwell on big tech. I mean, it only mentions the companies a few times. But I thought that being near the beginning of the book, it set it out pretty clearly that this movement is looking to build a resistance to big tech. And look, I have covered different people with different ideas on how to do that. And so I don't think there's actually one way to do it. I don't think there's one best way to do it. But I do think that the idea of getting together, as Peter Schmidt said, is a legitimate and a very powerful way of building some momentum, building some resistance to this multi-trillion dollar, multi-headed hydra of a beast that is trying to take over our attention and our lives, really. Every second of every day, these companies are trying to find ways to insert themselves and take over relationships and replace themselves where we used to have actual, genuine human relationships. I mean, it's a very, very destructive business model, and these companies are desperate to carry it out because they need growth. It's growth at any cost. And once they have reached multi-trillion dollar market valuations, they're thinking to themselves, we have to double again, and then we're going to have to double again, and then we're going to have to double again. And, I mean, you can look at that, friends, and you can see right away it's not going to work. But while these companies are still actively in operation, they are trying to destroy everything good that surrounds us. And so a resistance is going to have to be equally thoughtful and well organized. And I, as I told Peter, I really wish him and that whole community the best. And if you're interested in the links to the book and the School of Radical Attention, and to learn more about the Friends of Attention, all of that, go to the episode page, which is at tectonic.fm. That's tectonic.fm. And you can send me your comments. I'm at mark@tectonic.fm. That's mark@tectonic.fm. I'll read you one other selection, which came from a New York Times opinion piece that Peter and Graham Burnett and Alyssa Lowe published back in November of 2023. And I think Peter alluded to this during our interview. This was the piece, as I understand it, that really caught the attention of publishers because this is back in 2023. They so accurately diagnosed what was happening. And I think this is where they proposed the idea of human fracking. Here's what they wrote. "We are witnessing the dark side of our new technological lives, whose extractive profit models amount to the systematic fracking of human beings, pumping vast quantities of high-pressure media content into our faces to force up a spume of the vaporous and intimate stuff called attention, which now trades on the open market. Increasingly powerful systems seek to ensure that our attention is never truly ours." And again, so well put. What else do we have other than our choice of where to put our attention? And if we simply think, well, I'll do better tomorrow, you know, I will use these addictive social media services a little bit less tomorrow, working by ourselves, is going to be very difficult. If you're already at a point of addiction, it's going to be very difficult to rip yourself away from those platforms. But maybe if we band together, we'll have a better chance. So get together. And I didn't get into this with Peter in the conversation, but he and his co-editors did mention in the book, you know, whatever it is that you do to get together, you should do that. I mean, they mentioned a blacksmithing class, if that's what you want to do. If you enjoy a knitting circle or a sewing circle, go do that. If you like to play pickleball, like I do, go play pickleball. Go join or continue reading with your reading group or your book club. You know, all of those are good because those are where we get together. And so we're going to get through this together, friends. It feels good, and it's a point of optimism, a little bright ray of hope for all of us. And that's what I have for you today. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, a little bit of homework. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And to go out today, let's listen to one of my favorite songs by Decisive Pink. It's called Dopamine. Have a great one, everybody. I'll see you next time. Something to fill up the void and pleasure.
Hey there, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music right here at your favorite radio station, listener-supported WFMU. I'm Dave Mandel, your host, the host of this show. I'm here every Monday at 7 p.m., Snowmageddon or not. It's actually not so bad out there. Yesterday, for those of you who don't live in the area, for those of you who live in, you know, California or Hawaii or something, damn you, it's been pretty brutal out here, Snowmageddon, but it's actually been kind of cleaned up a lot over the last 24 hours, and I was actually able to get out to Jersey City happily, and here I am. So welcome to another installment of this show. Lots of outstanding music to play for you this evening. And we're going to start with something by the group Oregon. Now, Oregon, the guitarist in Oregon was a guy named Ralph Towner, who many of you will know, I'm sure, or know of. You might know him personally. It's possible. Ralph Towner sadly died a week or so ago. And he was a really, really great jazz, mostly jazz guitarist. I hate to pigeonhole him. And to my mind, kind of he just hadn't heard his name that much in recent years, it seems to me. He played on a lot of really, really great, he put out a lot of great albums on ECM, for one thing, in the 70s, 80s, and beyond. But he also played in this group, Oregon. Oregon was very interesting band in that they were sort of unclassifiable. I would call them sort of proto-world music before that was a thing, before the term world music came into use. They were around in the early 70s, which is very early for the kind of stuff they did. I think maybe like the Third Ear Band might be one of the few groups occupying this particular territory. Oregon brought together a lot of East-West influences. And again, Ralph Towner was the guitarist. Really, really original, creative guitarist. And they also had a tabla drum player, Colin Walcott. The thing about Colin Walcott is I always confuse him with Derek Walcott. Derek Walcott's a famous poet. Are they related? They may actually be related. I'm not sure. But whenever I see Derek Walcott's name mentioned, the rare time when I venture out into poetry land, I think they're talking about Colin Walcott, but no, they're two different people. Colin Walcott was a member of Oregon with Ralph Towner. Anyway, I would consider Oregon proggy in the or progressive in the sense that they were doing really adventurous music that was very different from what everyone else was doing at the time. And if that's not enough, there's more. The track I'm about to play, which is called Dark Spirit, from the album Distant Hills, probably my favorite Oregon album. This track has a section that's in 11/8 time. So, I mean, seriously. Oregon, Dark Spirit, Ralph Towner, RIP. Here we go. Thank you.